Well, welcome everybody, and thank you, Anthony. Thank you to Ari for organizing this talk this evening. As he mentioned, yes, it is my second talk. I was here 8 years ago when my first book came out as a first edition. And there's that book was republished as a second edition, revised, updated edition last year. So you have information on both these books with you. What I wanted to do this evening was give you a little bit of a background, an overview of the book itself, and talk a little bit about the research, and then walk you through a series of PowerPoints, walk you through some highlighted sections in the book. And then we'll, you know, open it up for some discussions and questions and answers at the end. The book is Diverse Early Childhood Education, Policies and Practices, Voices and Images from 5 Countries in Asia. My work, my research, my scholarship has focused largely on comparative and international education with a specific focus on South Asia and Asia in general. I first started working issues in education in India, and that's what my first book was about. And it really... is an in-depth exploration of early childhood education and early childhood teacher education in the context of India. From there, I kind of branched out a little bit and took my interest into a larger geographical area, and I looked at South Asia. This was an edited volume that was published in 2007. And I worked with a team of educators from each of the 8 South Asian countries just to put together an overview of the historical development of schooling and education in each of those countries. And then this book is my latest book, and it part of the research that I did for this book was as a Fulbright regional research scholar in 2010, and the rest of it was on my own as an independent researcher in and visiting Singapore as a visiting professor. So I put all this together, and this book came out in May and is published by Routledge. And just as an overview, it looks at what I was looking at was general trends and under the impact of globalization on what was happening in the field of early education in that part of the world. And not just early education, but also the preparation of teachers for early education, so the preparation of early childhood teachers. And I wanted to get a sense of what was going on, because I know that there was this that field is in flux in most of the world, globally. And I was interested to know what was going on currently, what were the current trends, what were the policy directions, what were the flows in policy, what were people thinking about, what were people talking about, what were the debates that were going on within the field. So that was pretty much what I was looking at. And when I wrote the book, it's not sectioned off into countries, but I wrote, there are 8 chapters in the book. The first is, of course, the introduction and setting the stage for diversifying the discourse of early childhood education and bringing into the discourse more of the non-dominant discourse that we usually talk about, specifically from the non-Western world. And I just want to kind of clarify when I say West is not a geographical direction that I refer to. It's really the dominant English-speaking white English-speaking world. And so it could be in the Western Hemisphere, it could be in the Eastern Hemisphere. As we know, Australia is in the Eastern Hemisphere. The second to the seven chapters are theme-based. And depending on some of the themes that emerge in my findings, I dedicated each of the chapters to a theme. So it's not country-wise. The book is not organized according to countries, but rather themes that emerged in my findings. And so there was one theme. So we have chapter... before I began the themes, chapter 2 was about the context, because I feel context is really important, and I'm going to talk more about that as I go through the book. But the second chapter was all about the cultural, sociocultural context of these countries. The third chapter is about... a topic in education that is very hotly debated around the world, and that is play-based and child-centered learning. And that is something where across the countries that I was in, there were major policy shifts in that area. So I'll talk a little bit about that. The fourth chapter was another emergent finding that came out to be very striking, and that was the teaching, how widespread the teaching of values was in schools, in countries, in all the countries, in all the schools that I went to, actually. The teaching of character values, citizenship values, and cultural values. The fifth chapter was on the curriculum itself, the classroom curriculum, and how local funds of knowledge emerge and get manifested into what teachers are doing in the classroom curriculum in terms of their teaching strategies, in terms of the classroom materials. There was a lot of reflection of the local cultural context. So the local funds of knowledge were being brought in. The sixth chapter was on some partnerships between teaching and learning, specifically between some schools and other organizations in the community. And then the seventh chapter was on teacher education and what were some of the current themes in teacher education right now, what were the shifts in policies, and what were the challenges that teacher education was facing in the field of early education in those countries. And then, of course, the last chapter was a concluding, you know, a reflective chapter summarizing and highlighting some of the characteristics and features that all the countries shared in terms of, and some of the recommendations that I make. So it's eight chapters. I'm not going to, there's no time to go through the whole book. And I've highlighted some sections just to share with you. I know this is a mixed audience. I know there are some students and some faculty members and some non-education-related people. I welcome all of you, and I'm going to try my best to make sure that I try to interest each one of you, right? So the first thing that people ask me is when I talk about the title of the book is, so what were these five countries? It's five Asian countries. And the five countries include India, China, Sri Lanka, Singapore, and the Maldives. And just so that everybody knows, some of these countries are really small. Some of them are really large. Here's India, and here's China. And right at the southern tip of India is an island, which is Sri Lanka. And right in the middle of the Indian Ocean here is a series of islands. It's an archipelago of islands, about 1,200 islands. And those are the Maldives. They're very, very tiny. And right here at the tip of Malaysia, right adjoining in the Indonesian islands, is the city country of Singapore. So just to kind of put things into a position and location so that you have that idea. So we talk about Asia. We've been talking about Asia as though it's one Asia, but it's really not one Asia. Asia is not one. And before I go on to that, I also want to put in a disclaimer that appears in my preface, that the purpose of this book was not to find a typical classroom or a typical school for each of these countries. There's immense diversity in these countries, and not only within the countries, but also within the schooling system. There are many different kinds of schools. And so my purpose, my aim was not to find a school that typifies all schools in any one country. But what I really wanted to do was to describe policy debates and instances of schooling and classroom practices at particular institutions as moments in time and as windows into some of the current thinking underlying early education in Asia. So it was really getting a glimpse of what's going on, getting a feel for what's going on, because the field is in a lot of flux right now, and there's a lot of change. Moment to moment, there's change happening, especially with early childhood education. And so coming to, there isn't one Asia. There isn't really one Asia. And Asia is a huge continent with numerous countries, and each country is as different from the others as possible. But even within each country, there's a huge amount of diversity. So there are these big, larger cultures and then subcultures within these larger cultures. And the countries that I selected were different in terms of, completely different in terms of geographies. They were different in terms of politics and governance, the kind of economy it is, even the dominant spiritual religious philosophies in each of these countries. So, you know, there was Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Taoism, and then there was Confucianism, a lot of different spiritual philosophies. huge number of languages. Just in these five countries, there were hundreds of languages that were being spoken. India itself is like about 1,600 dialects, right? So each part of India has a different language. Ethnicities, population sizes, huge difference in population sizes. Here we had India and China with populations with over a billion. You have 1.2 billion in India and over about a 1.3 billion in China. And then you had the smaller countries, Sri Lanka, which has a population of about 20 million, Singapore, which has a population of about 6 million, and then the Maldives, the smallest of the countries, which has a total population across those 1,200 islands of no more than 400,000. And 100,000 of them all concentrated on one island, which is the capital of the Maldives. It's a very, very urban little island, and it has a concentration of 100. It's a tiny island, no more than less than two square miles, maybe. And there are 100,000 people on that little tiny island. So just from this, you know that the sociocultural context of these countries was very, very diverse. So because there is this immense diversity, it's really important to keep in mind that education also gets impacted and influenced by the sociocultural context where you find education happening. And I want to share with you a quotation by Alexander, who's a very well-known scholar in comparative and international education. And he says, "Life in schools and classrooms is an aspect of a wider society, not separate from it. A culture does not stop at the school gates. The character and dynamics of school life are shaped by the values that shape other aspects of national life." So culture is really all. You cannot get away from the larger cultural context. It shapes everything, all educational decisions in schools and systems. So talking about that, let's take a look at one of our first highlighted sections, and this is on policy. And we're going to look at some policies, recent policies that impact early education in each of the five countries. And what the policies are really working toward is more inclusion, access and quality and child-centered pedagogy. And that's the thrust of the policies and recent policies and policy reform in education right now in each of these countries. So for instance, you have India and you have a series of recent policy documents. The turning point really happened in, happened in 2005 when the National Curriculum Framework was completely revised. And it, instead of urging the traditional teacher-directed approach to education, it was strongly recommending a child-centered approach to education, a learner-centered approach, learning that was more meaningful to the child. And this was a turning point because this was the first time a national policy document was recommending this. And then you had several other policies that followed. And basically, I'm going to read out just some of these. It's a common refrain that runs through all of these policy documents. There's a shift from traditional teacher-directed to child-centered approach. There's developmentally appropriate activity-based related to child's needs, interests, and abilities. So everything starting from the child. There's an integrated set of experiences to foster holistic growth. And these are the recommendations, that this is what education should involve for young children. That it should be flexible to adapt to diverse social, cultural, economic, linguistic contexts of India. And it should prepare children for the demands of formal teaching of primary schools. So you can see that there's still that tension of the academic rigor in primary schools and how do we prepare young children, give them a learner-centered education, and yet prepare them for the demands of primary school. In China, again, there was a series of policy reforms, and it really started earlier, in fact, in 1989, and more recent ones. But again, starting from there in 89, and then all the way until the last one that I looked at was 2010, the refrain through all of them, the urging, the shift that's happening is towards theme-based curriculum. So it's no more academic content areas, the focus on academic content areas, but really for young children, how do you do a project approach? How do you take a theme and then work on that? A decreased duration of a school lesson to allow children more free time to play. Child-initiated activity, individual developmental differences, the importance of play in early childhood classrooms. An integrated curriculum, a curriculum that combines the different content areas. So it's a theme. You take a theme and then see from that theme how you can teach children about math and social studies and the sciences and language and literacy. And the focus should be on process, not product. So it's the process of doing, working on a project, not the end product, but the process and what the children learn, what the child learns in the doing of it, not worrying about what the end product is going to look like. So those are some of, and you can, I'm not ready for Sri Lanka as yet. And you can hear, for those of you who are early childhood educators in this classroom, you can hear that familiarity, that it sounds very much like what we are doing as in child-centered education and early childhood education in this country, right? Or we're trying to do. Similarly, in Sri Lanka, in 2003, there was a cross-country study done by Abhyadeva, and she made recommendations to integrate the approach in early childhood education with regard to preschools and daycare centers. So whether it was for preschools and daycare centers, and even for preschool teacher education, her recommendation was we need to integrate, have an integrated approach. And what does that mean is all of these things, basically, all of the things that we had just read in the other countries as well. So one of their policy documents says that early childhood institutions in Sri Lanka should not be places where something is taught to the child, but centers with multiple activities for the overall development of personality, including the child's education. Preschool personnel should be appropriately trained in child development pedagogies. And schooling for young children should use a life skills approach that incorporates the four pillars of learning. Learning which, and these, this is taken from the spiritual philosophy of Buddhism, the four pillars of learning, which is the dominant philosophy, which is a dominant spiritual philosophy in Sri Lanka. 71% of the Sri Lankan population are Buddhists. And so the four pillars of learning basically refer to learning to know, learning to do, learning to live together with others, and learning to be. So you can see how their overall cultural, spiritual philosophies are seeping into their educational decisions as well. Okay. And then in Singapore, again, there was a series of policy documents. There's a kindergarten curriculum framework in 2003, which was just revised in 2013. And again, everywhere there is this effort to ensure, or a recommendation, that we have to ensure that for early childhood education, we're using a child-centered approach. Increase expectations for nursery and kindergarten teacher qualifications, because people realize that teachers are not prepared. So what happened was when the policy reform happened and occurred, and the shift happened from teacher-directed approaches to child-centered approaches, the biggest challenge and the biggest issue was there were no teachers who had been prepared in that new approach, in the new pedagogy. And so that was one of the biggest challenges. And so that's part of all of the policy reform, is that, along with changing the pedagogy in classrooms, we have to train teachers in that new pedagogy. The centrality of play, play has to be front and center in an early childhood classroom, and then have play-based experiences that are developmentally appropriate to the age of the children. And the view of children as curious, active, competent learners. An early childhood development agency was specifically created in Singapore just last year that brings together preschools and daycare, the child care division. And so they want to work together with the Ministry of Education and make sure that all schools for young children are offering this holistic approach to young children. Okay. And now the Maldives, I mean, it doesn't really matter. You go back and forth because the refrain is the same and the language in the policy documents is pretty much very similar and draws upon the language that we use here in the West in our early childhood education discourse. But in the Maldives as well, you can see that what they wanted to do with early childhood education was expand and improve comprehensive early childhood care and development, promote best practices, and again, play-based learning. And their national curriculum framework, which went into effect just a couple of years ago, listed key competencies in early childhood, and these include helping children learn how to relate to people, to be creative and critical thinkers. I'm sorry, I don't know why this keeps changing. And deepening an understanding of the self, practicing healthy living, practicing Islam, because that is the dominant religion in the Maldives. 99% of the population are Muslim. Knowing, learning how to use technology and media, and learning for sustainable development. Now, again, you'll see that these two are very much cultural goals, because the Maldives, it's first of all Islam, it's an Islamic country. And then learning for sustainable development. Sustainable development is critical to the future of Maldives, because as you might have heard, the Maldives islands, the highest point in all of those islands is about 10 feet. And with global warming, that's one of the first countries that's going to go underwater. And it's almost a given that the Maldives is not going to be existent in another 50 years. And so to be able to take care of their country and try to prolong that and try to make it as sustainable as possible, sustainable development is a major issue in the Maldives. All right. So this is all in policy, and this is all in the language of the policy, and these are the recommendations and the suggestions that the governments in all of these countries are now making to educators and teachers. But what is happening on the ground? What is happening in the classrooms? Is that policy being translated into classroom practice? So we're going to take a quick look at some of the classroom pedagogies. What are the teaching strategies in the classroom? What does it look like? Are teachers and educators following those policy recommendations? So what I saw, and I went to several schools in all of these countries, both government schools, which are called public schools, which are in Asia called government schools, and private schools, small schools, large schools, primary schools, looking at first grade and second grade, because that's all part of the early childhood domain, plus also nursery and kindergarten classrooms. And what I saw was both teacher-directed and child-centered practices. And there was a lot of child-centered stuff going on, but there was also a lot of teacher-directed stuff going on. So we've been talking a lot about child-centered, and before I show you images of classrooms, I want to kind of talk about, so what is child-centered? What is child-centered education? And the notion and the idea of child-centered education is rooted in John Dewey's ideas on progressive education, starting here in the turn of the century, early 20th century. John Dewey is known as the father of progressive education, and his ideas led to what we call child-centered education today. Because his ideas were starting with the needs and interests of the child. So you're starting with the child. You're not starting with a curriculum, and you're not starting with the teacher, and you're not starting with the policymaker saying this is what the child should learn. You're starting with who the child is and what the child, where the child is developmentally, and then taking it from there. So when you start with the child and the interests of the child, it's the interest of the child that's determining what teaching is going on in the classroom. And so the locus of control in classroom decisions lies in the child, not in the teacher. So that's basically the difference between a teacher-directed approach and a child-directed approach. And in an early childhood classroom, in a pre-K in the U.S., a child-centered classroom would be characterized by some of these strategies. And those of you who are teachers and early childhood educators in this room will know these are very familiar strategies to you. You don't really see all of these in primary school or, you know, high school or middle school, but you do see them in the early childhood classrooms. Circle time, multiple learning centers. So no tables and chairs and rows, but this room is set up in learning areas and learning centers, and children then make choices and choose to go to one of those centers to work. So that's a child-centered classroom. Individualized and differentiated instruction, whole language approach, thematic units based on children's interests, project activity-based learning, experiential learning, not, you know, drilling, not teaching them through just workbooks and a drilling of the, you know, academic work like numbers and alphabet and math. And there's a lot of focus on block building. Blocks are a big part of early childhood education. So this is the typical early childhood classroom in the Western context. This is what we would see in a lot of classrooms in the U.S. Now, what do these classrooms look like in Asia? And I have this first slide, which shows you a classroom. It's a community kindergarten in Singapore. And it looks pretty much child-centered, wouldn't you say? There's children's work that the children have done. Children have made their own drawings, and they've written each drawing is accompanied. You can't see it here, but each drawing is accompanied by their dictated stories. And, you know, they're displayed all over the room. There's not much commercial stuff going on the walls. And so it looks like they're sitting in groups and working, and looks like a pretty child-centered approach from this particular perspective. Here's another instance of a Singapore kindergarten, and this is a play-based example. And this is in the housekeeping area. Like I said, early childhood classrooms have learning centers, and one of the centers typically in an early childhood classroom is a housekeeping area where children play out the roles that they see adults playing out in their daily lives. So this was one housekeeping area that had been converted into like a food court to reflect what the food courts, many food courts in Singapore. Singapore has a lot of food courts. And so children had these food courts with the different cuisines that are popular in Singapore, and they were playing in the housekeeping area. So those, you could say, is very child-centered, right? But here you see in the same school, in the same kindergarten, this was a special room called the phonics room. And after the children would spend most of the day in their child-centered classrooms, they would be brought into this phonics room for about 30 or 40 minutes a day. And here they would be given a more teacher-directed lesson in language, literacy, and math. And this is where they were taught, like, in a more formal manner, the ABCs and the 1-2-3s. This is Sri Lanka. And this was a classroom for four-year-olds. And again, you see this very wonderful set of paintings that children have done, very much like paintings are the children in early childhood classrooms in the U.S. do, using paint. There's creativity. They're using their imagination. Each painting is different. So again, you would say, well, this is a very child-centered example in this classroom. But at the same time, there are activities where you see this happening, where children are sitting as a group, which is good. They're not sitting individually. But some of the work that they're doing is very cookie-cutter type. Everybody's doing the same thing, and they're expected to do the same thing. You can see that displayed on that bulletin board, that all the work done by each child is very much the same. So that would be quite structured and quite teacher-directed. And then you have another image from a Sri Lankan classroom about how there was one wall in one classroom which was completely plastered by the Sinhalese alphabet. And they try to make it more interesting and colorful and, you know, with illustrations, but it was still, the focus was very much on academics. In the Maldives, again, I visited several schools. This was a government school, and this was a first grade classroom, and right outside, you can see there is this bulletin board, and you have drawings by children. Whoops. This has a mind of its own. And each drawing is different. Children have, again, there's creativity and imagination. And at the same time, there is also this going on in the classroom where it's definitely a very structured, teacher-directed approach, right? This is in China, again, very child-centered. You have all this art material, manipulatives. They can take materials from here, come to these tables and work on it. And then you have this beautiful artwork where each child has created his own or her own design. This is to imitate the blue and white pottery that you get in China. And children had taken paper plates, painted them cobalt blue, and then with this white paint made these intricate designs. These are five-year-olds. And you wouldn't see our five-year-olds doing this here, right? So although the designs were individual and each child had designed his her own plate, they were all doing the same thing. Similarly here, this was something that four-year-olds did. These were umbrellas. And each child had designed her or own umbrella. But you can see that these are the spokes of the umbrellas. And you can see the intricate design that's gone into. And these are four-year-olds. So again, the fine motor skills that they were working with was quite incredible. It's not surprising to see that outside of the U.S., however, because if you are familiar with the Reggio Emilia system of schools in Italy, they do this kind of incredible artwork. And that is like the goal for every early childhood school in the U.S. wants to be a Reggio school today. It's the latest, you know, the buzz is we want to be a Reggio school, right? All right. And then at the same time, the same children in the Chinese classroom, they had this very structured activity. Just to give you an idea, there were 30 children in this classroom, 34-year-olds. And there were two teachers. And then for this particular activity, there was one teacher who was helping them learn the school drew a lot from the Chinese traditional culture. And they were learning about Chinese opera, Peking, Beijing opera. And they were, in this particular instance, there was a teacher on this side who was teaching them gestures and facial expressions of how to perform in the Chinese opera, some of the characters in Chinese opera. But again, very much teacher-directed. And so you saw that there was a lot of child-centered work as well as teacher-directed work that was going on. And so how do you define it? There was this gray area. It wasn't a purely child-centered classroom, and it wasn't a purely, teacher-directed classroom. And there was this mix of different approaches, and there was this murkiness. Do you call it this or do you call it that? How do you define it? And I just want to read out a little paragraph from my book. That although child-centered pedagogy in general is couched within the Western progressive discourse, what gets implemented around the world is an iteration of a child-centered pedagogy that is more aligned to the local context. So what they're doing is they're taking that and they're aligning it to what makes sense to them. Programs in which the classroom environment was child-centered in being colorful and expressive may not necessarily have been really child-centered with respect to the locus of control which still lies within the teacher. On the other hand, classroom environments that may not have visually appeared to resemble the Western progressive child-centered classrooms may in fact have offered more authentic child-centered experiences to meet the needs of the students. And I have an example to give to you about how this works in a school in the Maldives. It was a primary school, a primary government school, and they had classes from pre-K up to fifth grade. And they had this particular school had a kind of an inclusion program for students who were hearing impaired. Now, I won't call it inclusion, because the way we define inclusion here is not what they were doing there. So I won't call it our definition of inclusion. But they had students who were hearing impaired, but they were taught separately in a separate classroom. And they had there's no teacher training there for special needs. There's no teacher training. Nobody has been trained to teach children who might have any kind of a special need or any kind of a disability. And so what would happen was there was team teaching. So for a math class, for instance, the math teacher would be there, and then there would be a sign language teacher. and then the math teacher would say something, and then the sign language teacher would translate that for the children in the classroom, for the students. And that's how instruction was delivered. It was through a translator, through an interpreter. But what also happened, children mixed with the other children in the school. They all mixed on special events like assemblies and school events and cultural events. But what was significant about the school was they had, so the Maldivian government just that year, this was 2010, had come out with a sign language dictionary for the first time in the country. Their local language is Divehi. And so there was an English Divehi bilingual sign language dictionary that they had published. And one copy of the dictionary was given to the student who was hearing impaired, and one copy was given to his family or her family so that they would learn how to communicate with the child. And then every morning they had school assembly, the whole school. Once a week during that assembly, the entire school would be taught five new words in sign language. And I thought that that was a remarkable instance of how inclusion can happen, one way inclusion can happen. This was certainly not mainstreaming and certainly not a classroom where you had students who with and without disabilities, but it was a school, it was in the school ethos that they wanted to include the students and they wanted the all students to be able to communicate with students who are hearing impaired. And to be able to take the needs of a very marginalized, small minority group in the school and try to make sure that all students are addressing that, I thought was a wonderful instance of a child-centered approach. I mean, if that's not child-centered, I don't know what is. Given that maybe in classrooms they're still doing workbooks, but it was the ethos and the desire to want to meet the needs of children. And I think that's something that one has to acknowledge. So what are the issues? What is the issue when we talk about this whole debate between child-centered and teacher-directed and the policies that have in the developing world that have been completely changed to reflect child-centered recommendations, but yet on the ground, the ground realities in the classroom are that it's not really not happening to that extent. Well, the problem arises when local programs are evaluated by early childhood educators who have been trained in the Western discourse. So they have, when schools in the developing world get evaluated and assessed through a set of standards that have emerged and been contextualized in the Western school or Western educational system, then obviously you're going to find those schools lacking in something. It's because we're taking one set of standards and applying it to a whole different context, and that's where the issue lies. And the reality is that the dichotomy between child-centered and teacher-directed is a false dichotomy. The reality is that when we are teaching children, there's always some things that are child-centered and always some things that are more teacher-directed. You cannot have a classroom that's 100% child-centered and 100% or 100% teacher-directed. So that dichotomy and the debate becomes almost kind of irrelevant because you can't have a classroom that is completely child-centered. That some teacher, even John Dewey said, that the teacher is the more mature adult in the classroom and needs to take charge of planning for that classroom. And so the minute you say that, that puts the teacher also in a position of authority and control. That is not child-centeredness. So there's a lot of murkiness around these issues. So I'm going to kind of share with you another finding that showed up, and this was, as I mentioned to you earlier, widespread teaching of values, citizenship values, character values, cultural values in all classrooms. And this happened regardless of which school I went to, whether it was a government school, a private school, it was any of the countries, it was in a small town, large town. It was just everywhere. And I'm going to give you some images to look at. Here is a private school in Sri Lanka. And right outside the principal's office was his bulletin board. And, let's read out one of these things. 30 years is... So we speak different languages. We come from different cultures. We keep different... traditions. No matter who you are or where you are not responsible for the past, but you are for the future. 30 years from now, it won't matter what shoes you wore, how your hair looked, or the jeans you bought. What will matter is what you learned and how you used it. So there are these messages that are given to children across schools. That's one example. This was in the Maldives on the playground. There was this big kind of board here with these wooden slats, and on each of them was painted a virtue like caring, respect, fairness, citizenship, responsibility, trustworthiness. And each of these, there were posters for each of these defining what each of these were all throughout the school, in the hallways, in the stairwells, everywhere. So again, children getting these messages about these are the important virtues, you know, these are the important values. In Singapore, you know that Singapore is a rule-based society and rules are enforced very strictly in Singapore. And so because that's a national priority and a national value, that got included in one of these classrooms that I visited, and there was this whole thing on rules, classroom rules, and children had created these, children had created these little posters. So this one says, please put the slippers properly. In Singapore and in the Maldives, everybody takes their shoes and slippers outside the classroom, and you come into the classroom without your shoes. And so there was, just outside near the classroom door, was this little poster that says, please put your slippers properly. And these, a list of children who had made this and created this little poster. Then switch off the lights. And this little poster was created by this group of children and was posted right under the light switches, right? And so there were other rules. There was, please wash your hands properly in the bathroom near the sink. So there were these little rules that children had participated in creating, and reminders for everybody. And that reflected the national focus on rules in Singapore. Another one in Singapore, there's a national goal for religious and racial harmony. And right in the lobby of one of the schools, this was a primary school, there was this pillar. And right on that, there was this beautiful painting which says, I must preserve racial and religious harmony. It's not very clear, but that's what it says. And then you can see that this is, you know, there are four main ethnic groups in Singapore, and it reflects each of those four groups. A slum school in India. It was in a neighborhood. It was in a slum. Everybody's seen Slumdog Millionaire. You know what a slum is. It's a neighborhood where people live in abject poverty. It's a community. And right in the middle of one of those such communities, there was a school for the children of that slum. And it was a beautiful environment. Once you got inside the school, there was this beautiful environment of folk art painted on the walls and everything. And again, a pillar, right? Very, very much in the center, there was this pillar that the seas have been a part of our classroom forever. And then there's a list of the seas that they held dearly. Curiosity, creativity, competence, confidence, concern, cooperation, citizenship, commitment, critical thinking. So again, what is it? What are the messages you're giving the children? What do we want to teach children? It's very explicit in school environments. In a private primary school in India, this was just one out of many that I saw on the school walls. And this was actually outside, on the outside, outer wall of the school. And this it's interesting. It says, five important lessons to learn from a humble pencil. First, it tells you that everything you do will always leave a mark. Second, you can always correct the mistakes you make. Third, what is important is what is inside you and not outside you. Fourth, in life you will undergo painful sharpenings which will make you better in whatever you do. And last, to be the best, you must allow yourself to be held and guided by the hand that holds you. So I don't know what I mean, but this is what was on, you know, the walls. You may agree with it, you may not agree with it, but I just wanted to share that, you know, this is what the children are reading, this is what the school teachers and administrators want children to know. And so those are the values. So I want to come to some conceptual, some theoretical ideas, kind of under the theoretical underpinnings of my research and my work. And I usually approach all my research and work through the lens of post-colonial theory and globalization. So just very quickly, what is post-colonial theory? There's a huge body of scholarship on this, but just in a nutshell, it's a research paradigm that seeks to situate contemporary educational issues in the context of underlying colonial experiences. Now, one might think that colonial means, oh, but some of these countries didn't have a colonial past, and colonial is only political colonialism. But the definition of colonialism that I engage with, and that a lot of post-colonial theorists engage with, is that colonialism is viewed as imposing an ideological yardstick against which others are measured and found wanting. That is a colonized condition. When a dominant group imposes a worldview or ideas on a weaker minority or marginalized group, that is a condition of colonization. And so when you think about colonialism from that angle, I love this quotation by Donaldo Macedo, who says, then the colonized condition can be found everywhere, in concentration camps without the barbed wires in the First World, in ghettos, in the rural mountains of Appalachian and Indian reservations, and in the large-scale exploitation produced by the policies of neoliberalism. And so when you look at that, you say, well, education has a lot of that going on. If we're taking a Western discourse, a dominant discourse, and imposing it upon a school in a developing country, we need to know whether if that is the colonized condition, if we're creating a colonized condition. So another thing about post-colonial theory is this notion of cultural hybridity. So one of the outcomes of a post-colonial experience in the colonized condition is that there's involved a powerful interdependence. There's a two-way transaction, a two-way dialogue between the ideas and philosophies of the colonizer, the dominant group, and the ideas and philosophies of the minority group, the marginalized group, the colonized. And because of this two-way dialogue, a transcultural mixing takes place. And there's an exchange of cultural elements. So that's one thing that one needs to keep in mind, this notion of cultural hybridity. And then why I use post-colonial theory is because it allows the three kind of reasons I put down here. One, it allows for the understanding of alternative perspectives of the other. So the other meaning the non-dominant group. It allows to draw attention to under-researched areas within educational literature while opening up possibilities to challenge existing theoretical perspectives. And thirdly, it helps address the complexities of cultural hybridization. Because when cultures come together and that exchange takes place, what is created is that third space of cultural hybridity, and that can be a very gray, murky area. Nothing is clear there. And so post-colonial theory helps to address those gray areas. Along with cultural hybridity, if that process happens in schools and in classrooms where educational philosophies and educational ideas come together and they start intermingling, then just like a space of cultural hybridity occurs, a space for pedagogical hybridity occurs because different pedagogies are coming together. And so again, in classrooms, it's created a space where there are different pedagogies, and we saw some of those instances that they're doing this and they're doing that, right? Now, what happens in practice if we looked at those images of classrooms where there were different things going on, and we want to connect that to post-colonial theory and the theoretical ideas, this is something that has been described by Wang and Spodek but with reference to the Chinese educational landscape. And they say that progressive pedagogies are being enacted alongside neoliberal economics in a society that has for centuries been shaped by Confucian and socialist values. These forces collide and result in creating tensions between traditional and modern cultures, Eastern and Western spirits, socialist and capitalist ideological elements within which changes and continuities coexist. So it's that whole idea of coexisting, that things, there's that mixing of things and coexistence of things, right? Now this, they wrote with reference to Chinese education, but you can, it happens, it pretty much happens across other cultures as well. This is something, like an instance, an example of the kind of hybridity I saw, and I want to talk a little bit about this from my earlier research. I was looking at early childhood classroom curriculum in India. And after trying to tease apart the enacted early childhood curriculum, the closely intertwined strands from three distinct discourses could be identified in the classrooms included in my study. These discourses represented the deeper underlying educational purposes that reflected ideas from Indian philosophy, which influenced both the content of curriculum and the methodology of teaching. So, you know, like in the teaching of values and all of that. So there was one discourse which was from Indian philosophy, education related to Indian philosophy. The second one was a policy that had been put in place by British colonial administrators in colonized idea, which dominated the content and methodology and was manifest in the rigidly structured tests and workbook curriculum. This came about in the mid-19th century when education was completely changed. In Macaulay's Minute, you know, India was ruled by British administrators for a long, long time. And in the mid-1800s, one of the British administrators, Macaulay, he came out with a document called Macaulay's Minute, which was mandated that all schools in India, if they want financial help and if they want to be aided by the British government or by the British administration, have to use English as the language of instruction. Otherwise, they're not going to be supported by the administrators. And that is where things changed in Indian education. That is where the exam system and teaching to the test and teaching to the exam, textbook system, exam-driven by textbooks, all of that came into place after that because they had full control. And so that's when it became very rigidly academic, very structured and exam-oriented. So that, which till now still exists, right? So that is the second discourse of British policies, colonial policies. And then the last one was the traces of some core concepts from progressive education that are commonly seen in many American classrooms. And this was evident in the teacher's desire to work towards child-centered practices. So some classrooms were having circle time and some choice time, activity-based stuff. So that was a discourse that was influenced by progressive education of the West. So you could see that in any classroom, there were three discourses that were influencing the curriculum. Now, similarly, in China, in a similar manner, Zhu in 2008 notes that the occurrence of pedagogical hybridity in early childhood education in China reveals the three distinct cultural threads of traditional, communist, and Western cultures. How? The influence of the communist culture is evident in practical aspects of kindergarten curriculum, such as organization, administration, and curricular goals and content. The traditional influence is evident in the ideological and philosophical ideas, such as views of the teacher-child, the teacher-child interactions, and the processes of teaching and learning. And finally, the influence of Western cultures has been introduced through exposure to diverse early childhood models such as Montessori, Reggio Emilia, high school project approach, and the developmentally appropriate practices. So again, even in the context of China, these researchers found that there were three different discourses that were coming together and influencing what was happening in the classrooms. My second framework and theoretical framework is on globalization, and I just want to give you a few definitions that I engage with. Globalization, the definition is an intensification of worldwide social relations which link localities in such a way that local happenings are shaped by events happening many miles away and vice versa. This is one definition that I engage with. with globalization, we also talk about neoliberal globalization. The globalization of capitalism, which constitutes the most recent wave of globalization. Technically speaking, globalization is not a new concept. It has been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years, ever since the first trade route started, right? Because what is globalization is the flow of ideas, the flow of material, the flow of goods, the flow of practices from one part of the world to the other across the globe. That basically, simplistically, is what globalization means. So it's been happening for hundreds of years. And the latest wave of globalization today is neoliberal globalization. Is the flow of capitalism across the world, right? And then we also talk about the globalization of education, where the world, which is the worldwide discussions, processes, and institutions affecting local educational practices and policies. What is the time? Okay. I'm going to see if we can skip some of the slides, so in the interest of time. So you, I'm going to show you a few images of how this, there was a juxtaposition, coming together, the coexistence of different, of the global and local, of creative and academic, of structured and unstructured, and how that came together in the same classroom. So here we have the same slum school. This is a classroom for three-year-olds. This is a group of three-year-olds sitting with their teacher. And the teacher is no more qualified with a high school degree, perhaps even that, I don't know. And what she's doing is she's working with flashcards that she has created and made where she's teaching children, the three-year-olds, how to, words in English. And these children come from the slums and live in abject poverty and come from very, very poor families. But it's important that they learn English, and that's the influence of globalization that's happening. Here is a classroom on the left. It's a classroom in Singapore, and I was very surprised to see that in a kindergarten classroom, five-year-olds were doing a retrospective on Keith Haring and his paintings. And so the teacher had put up these prints on the bulletin board, and the children had been asked to pick one of them that they liked and try to recreate it in their own way. Okay. And similarly, on that side, this is in a school in India. And in their one of the bulletin boards, they had this wonderful display of Jackson Pollock art and the children learning the Jackson Pollock way. And so I really thought this was such a wonderful example of globalization, how Western art and artists are being taught in Indian and Singaporean classrooms. Here is a school for street children. This was in Kolkata in India, and it's an NGO school. NGO is a non-governmental organization. This was because there's no money, and NGOs work to work with very, very poor neighborhoods with very poor children, very poor families. They have to make do with whatever they have. And this school had been created. It used to be a big trash receptacle. And it was about a box, about 30 feet by 10 feet. And they had cleaned it out, totally cleaned it out, painted it, and then they had made it into a school. And there were 30 children in there. And there were four different groups with different age groups. So there was one group with three and four-year-olds sitting there on one side of that box with their teacher. And then there was a group of six and seven and eight-year-olds, and then, and so on, until there was an older group, high school students. But within that one little room, there was all this teaching going on, and the children seemed very engaged in what was happening. But it was interesting to see how they had taken Montessori materials. These are typical, very specific Montessori materials, all of these. And along with this, there was also very progressive, child-centered work that was going on here, and children's work was being displayed. And also, again, this juxtaposition of different kinds of pedagogies. Here, a private school in Mumbai in India, you have this very academic activity going on. Children learning, very teacher-directed, learning the 1, 2, 3s. And the same children then taken out to the local vegetable market to buy some vegetables. So again, a very activity-based, experiential example, plus a very teacher-directed academic example. So there were these examples, this juxtaposition of different kinds of things in everywhere that I went. And so just concluding thoughts. So there were some commonalities in Asian perspectives on education. So although these countries were all very different, there were some ideas and some perspectives that they all shared. And one, in all of them, education was viewed as all-encompassing, formal and informal. And there was an understanding that children learn not only in classrooms, but also outside of the classroom, which led to the idea that all adults are the child's teachers. Any adult in the child's life would be the child's teacher and could teach them, could reprimand them without anyone objecting to it. These countries all had very long traditions of education, centuries and centuries of education. The image of the status and image of the teacher was one of respect. They had high status. In fact, there was a study done last year where a cross-country study, global study, and the countries that came up where teachers are most respected and have the highest status were countries like China, South Korea, Singapore. There was a shared value for education. Education is a priority with families, and they will do whatever they can and to make sure that their children are educated in the best possible way. So for them, spending will come secondary to saving for their child's education. The two things that parents in India, and I'll talk about India, but I'm sure this is true of some of the other Asian countries as well, but parents in India save for two reasons. One is to get their child married and one is to get their child educated. Right, so that education is a priority. It's one of the most big priorities in India and other Asian countries. These were cultures of caregiving communities. These were interdependent cultures. These were not cultures that are based on individualism and independence. So communities came together, and there was this sense of interdependence, that we're all dependent on each other and we all do for each other. These were cultures where multiple mothering took place. So mothering, a child didn't have one mother, but every woman in the family was a mother to the child. And every woman in the family had the right to reprimand the child or love the child, that the mother would not object to it if somebody else in the family came and reprimanded her child. Whereas here, we don't interfere. There's a very strict boundary between somebody else's child and what you can say to that child, right? But here there was an instance of multiple mothering. Large class sizes were typical in all of these schools, in all of these countries. And the smallest school in one of the private schools, smallest class size I saw was 25 children in one classroom with one or two teachers. And it can go up to as high as 50, 60 children, 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds in one classroom. So the class sizes, they deal with huge, huge class sizes. When I was in India years and years ago, I taught in 1988 for 4 years. I was a nursery school teacher there. In my classroom, I had 43-year-olds, and I was the only teacher. So I know that that's a fact, that that does happen, right? Competitive ethos in the school. There was a sense of competition everywhere. And this could be to some extent, due to the large populations, that everything, you have to fight for everything. You have to deal with and navigate with large numbers of people all around you always, whether you're in the marketplace, whether you're on public transportation, whether you're on the streets even, whether you're in a school, whether you're in the job market. The numbers that you have to compete with are enormous, and that leads to this ethos of competition that gets created in educational systems. So it's like there's a competition to get into school, a competition to get into college, a competition to get the job. It's competitive here in New York City, but it's 100-fold competitive especially in India and China, where the populations are so large. But there's also, interestingly, they view effort. There's a difference in how success is viewed and failure is viewed. And success is viewed as a factor of effort, not ability. Whereas here, the success is viewed as a factor of ability. You're able to do it and you have the ability, so you succeeded. But there, it's not an ability. You put in hard work and you'll succeed. So there's a difference in how success and failure are viewed in the two cultural contexts. Teaching of values and academic proficiency, very important in their schools. And there's been a recent emphasis on child-centeredness and the English language. English language, the learning of English language has become a priority. The poorest family in India, in Africa also, a lot of developing countries, poor families are saving everything that they can so that they can send their children to a private school because private schools use English as a language of instruction. Government schools in India cannot use English as a language of instruction because, you know, it's a government school, so they use regional languages. But private schools do, and so the poorest of families wants to send their child to private school. And you'll see a lot of those slum children go to private schools because they want their children to learn English, and you saw the teacher teaching them English, right? So that's it's become, and everywhere you'll see learn English, classes to learn English, English tutorials, everything, everywhere, in every country. There are posters on the walls, and everywhere there are billboards that, you know, advertise English, learn English, English-speaking classes, conversational English, learn English without an accent, you know, those kinds of things everywhere. So there's a huge focus on the learning of English skills right now. So with globalization, there's been created new benchmarks with regard to knowledge, skills, and attitudes. And so there's no doubt that every society is not only becoming increasingly diverse and multicultural, and so teachers have to learn about cultural awareness and also cultural empathy. But so what are these benchmarks? And there were 8 characteristics that were compiled by a large group of scholars on character and citizenship education. And they said that in the 21st century, successful citizens need to have some of these features, need to demonstrate these abilities. Ability to approach problems as members of a global society, no longer local, but being aware of the global. Ability to work with others in a cooperative way and to take responsibility for one's roles and duties within society. So citizenship, being responsible for your, being a productive citizen in your community, in your society. Ability to understand, accept, appreciate, and tolerate cultural differences. You cannot be intolerant now about cultural differences because you're going to be working with a lot more people from different cultures. That's the nature of work now. The capacity to think in a critical and systematic way, willingness to resolve conflict in a nonviolent manner, willingness to change one's lifestyle and consumption habits to protect the environment, again, has become very important, protection of the environment. Ability to be sensitive towards and to defend human rights, and a willingness and ability to participate in politics at local, national, and international levels. So these are things that people, scholars have said, that this is what we need to keep in mind and at the center of our educational goals, that this is how do we raise a generation of children who will become citizens in a 21st century, successful citizens, productive citizens in a 21st century world. One of them, of course, is also to strengthen teacher education. And I'll skip this because I know we're running out of time, so I'll just end. Just end with a little paragraph from my book, that in going through the descriptions in this book, readers might find images of early childhood classrooms that look similar or different to their own. And this is, of course, talking to the early childhood educators in this room. In the former instance, it would strengthen their own views, and in the latter instance, it would provide them with a challenge to grapple with a view different from their own. In either case, it is an opportunity for all to consider and reflect upon our own and others' ideas, and to better understand how education is viewed and imparted in different parts of the world, and perhaps be inspired to rethink some aspect of our own practice or create our own unique plan for early childhood education. So that is the end, and I'm happy to take questions. And can you also tell us who you are? And
I am just the working in a society, and I'm a teacher.
All right.
Okay. My question is, I see many Indian people working in my office also, and they speak very good English. So mm-hmm. I wonder, when they have a child, they must be speaking English in the family also. So I'm wondering, why they are so eager to send the child to.
That's a good question. So the people who already speak English in India have gone through a system of private schooling, and private schools could only be afforded by people who can afford it. But people who could not afford private schooling sent children to government schools, and they did not speak English. But today, because of globalization, even the poor families think that they want their children to know English, because it'll give them an edge then going forward. So that's why the poor families want to send their children to private schools now.
The Indian people that we are seeing in this country, they are sort of a next stage. So all of them speaking English so well.
Yeah, they probably went to private schools and were taught in English. Would you agree? Yeah. Okay.
Hi. I'm a student in the graduate center.
Okay.
I'm also a trained lawyer.
Okay.
But I'm very interested in education, primarily because of the domestic debate in America, to some extent in the other countries, about reforming education and all the difficulties of that. But I guess from that perspective, what interests me about these five countries is that they all seem to be, all of a sudden, relatively recently, all converging. And I guess the question is, are there very large forces at work here that are also driving the demand for reform in the U.S. and to some extent in Europe? Is it because of these international tests that all of a sudden China is doing very well in, and Finland with their very unusual system is also doing very well in, and the U.S. and U.K. and I imagine most of the other countries are doing very poorly in? What's going on? Like, what's driving all this desire to implement these national plans, et cetera?
That's a good question, too. And I think there are a couple of different things that are happening. One is, specifically for early childhood education, you can relate it to the UN's, EFA, Education for All goal, and 2015 was their deadline. And the goal was that by 2015, and this was done about 20 years ago, the treaty was ratified by most of the countries, that by the year 2015, every child in the world should be in a school. And one of the sub-goals of the Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, was that we have to offer quality early childhood education. So because that's a global goal, and so to meet that goal by 2015, there was this rush by governments to try and improve the field of early education. But the content of early education and why they are doing this whole... what is quality? I mean, again, we can argue about what is quality, but they've taken quality education to be what they see in Western countries, in Western schools, which, again, I don't know, we can argue about it. But, and that is driven, that whole thing, and even here, even in Obama's administration, now you know that the economists are feeding into this whole notion, and there was this huge study that came up, and that's why this universal pre-K, push for universal pre-K even in the US, because research by economists showed that good investment in early childhood education, a sound investment in early childhood education, ultimately benefited the economy of the nation. That for economic benefit in the future, because then you spent less. Later on, as these children grew up, they were arrested fewer times, there were fewer felonies, there were fewer dropouts, there was more employment, and so ultimately it worked out that they were actually contributing to the nation's economy. And so that has been taken, and because And now other countries are taking that same research base and the same reasoning that we want to do this because it's going to benefit, ultimately it will benefit the economy of the country. That's why there is this push to improve education. But there's always this debate about what is quality education, right? Brent?
Yeah, I had a question about India in particular, because I know there's some excitement, at least in this country, I think, about the new president, the political shift, and I'm curious about Modi,
right, yeah.
I'm curious about his stance on education, because
it's a great question, and I wonder if somebody can help me answer that. I'm not too sure. Yeah, Veena, right?
Yeah.
Tell us your bag, who you are.
I run a non-profit called the India Center, and we promote Indian culture, and I have nothing to do with education, but I was very curious because it mentioned India. Modi has this thing about girls' education, mm-hmm. and he's very focused on women's education, and as the chief minister of Gujarat, he kind of did a lot of things in order to promote female education. So there is this belief that if you educate one female, you educate the whole family, whereas if you educate a boy, you just educate the boy. So mm-hmm. there is this whole thing. So he's very, very focused
on education. Okay.
On female education. That's what I've read.
Okay. Does anybody have... Yeah, Maitri?
Oh, nothing to add to that.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks, Veena. So, yeah.
My question was that, you know, of all the things you said, the classroom sizes, for example, because in America they always say, you know, classroom size should be smaller, etc. When I went to college, we had 150 students per class, and everybody did okay.
Yeah.
And another thing about India was when I came to America, one of my friends had a kid who was 2.5 years old. And I said, oh, don't you teach the kid to read and write? And he said, no, we wait till they're 5. And I thought that was very interesting because when I was growing up, as soon as the child was old enough to speak, the child says, Mama, Papa, and you start teaching A, B, C, D, and, you know, whatever, letters, etc. So I was very surprised that they didn't teach till 5. So, you know, did you find in Asia that people taught their kids long before they even went to school?
They did. In fact, Sri Lanka has a tradition that the minute the child is 3, suppose a learned person has to come, and it's actually a tradition in the culture of Sri Lanka that a learned person comes and starts teaching that child. So I don't know. But I also want to say that the 150 students in college, I mean, there are undergrad classrooms here with 500 students and all, right? But definitely in schools, in young classrooms for young children, where there shouldn't be too many children, the class sizes should be a little small. And again, it's a very arbitrary number about what is the right class size. Who knows? It all depends on the context. But in India, definitely, it was a bit too much. Like 50 and 60 children, 4-year-old children, 5-year-old children in one classroom would be a bit too much. So I don't know. But I do want to say, in terms of policy change, and you might be wondering, and you might be even thinking, that as I was going through this talk and presentation, the policies in Asia are changing from an academically rigorous system to a more learning is fun system, where there is a promotion of creativity, nurturing of the imagination, freedom of expression in classrooms for children. And you might say, well, that's puzzling because the reverse seems to be happening in the U.S. right now with high-stakes testing, with, race to the top, and all of those things. We're getting more and more involved in making our system more academically rigorous. And I think what you said earlier is these international tests are part of that equation, that when students all around the world take that one test, and American students have consistently been performing at the lower end, our policymakers have been trying to understand why that's happening and why that. So they're trying to change that. And at the same time, students and policymakers in Asia, I'll get to you in a minute, have realized also that their systems were too academically rigorous and too structured, and their students were not being able to be as creative and as expressive as the American students. And that is exactly what is happening in the two different parts of the world. Policymakers have been putting into place policies to fill the gaps in their respective systems. So here we want more academic rigor, which in a way is good, because the statistics say that 70% of freshmen who go to college cannot read at 12th grade level. And that is a little alarming, right? So you do want our students to be a little better in their academic foundations and academic grounding. But we don't want to lose what has been good about our system, about that whole idea of students being creative and expressive in the classroom. And on that side of the world, they want a little more expression and creativity and imagination in their curriculum, but they don't want to lose. Their students have been good in academics, so they don't want to lose that. So the challenge is, how do you hold on to what has worked in your system, but fill the gaps, fill what has been missing in your system? And that's where I think people are working on globally.
I am. Many, I teach privately, mm-hmm. so I don't, you know, work with the people or any of the educational system. And I basically have had a problem with what goes on in these schools on a personal level and on an institutional level. Dealing with my daughter, who went to a so-called dual language school, mm-hmm. that put a lot of the principles of so-called rigorism. And basically, what I found is it just dulls the child. It stops the child from being creative. And on a personal level, I had a friend who went to a school that was run by hippies in Minnesota. And they were learning Shakespeare while other people were taking all these stupid tests. But she came to New York and got a full scholarship to NYU. So what is education?
Yeah, and what is education, right? There is no, what is education? How do you define education? And I think people define it in different ways. And unfortunately, there are policymakers who make those policies who are not necessarily educators and teachers in the classroom. And so how do we...
And then it deals with Texas. Yeah. Because Texas prints up all the textbooks, and those people aren't teachers at all.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm an educator, and I have some experience leading a Singapore curriculum school in Cambodia.
Oh, okay.
So my question is about the colonial ambitions of China, Singapore, India, and how they sort of project their soft power by using maybe textbooks or the magic, so-called magic of their method in neighboring countries or other countries that are not neighbors in Asia or elsewhere around the world. Do you have any knowledge of how that works? Because I know Singapore
has the math, right? The Singapore math, which
Singapore
is used
math, even in New York.
Yeah, they're using it.
Singapore,
yeah.
Singapore reading curriculum uh-huh. is popular in probably certain private schools
yeah.
in Vietnam, Thailand, you know,
right.
Southeast Asia.
Sure, sure. And so I think, yes, and it becomes this globalization within regions as well. It's not necessarily an East-West thing, but even within South Asia, you have these countries like the Maldives and Sri Lanka and, Nepal. They're all looking to India and exporting from India their curricula and their methods also.
And maybe Sri Lanka and exports some of its Buddhism to other Buddhist countries?
Well, there are many other countries that are Buddhist, many, many other countries that are Buddhist, predominantly Buddhist, like Cambodia, I think Vietnam, Thailand very much, right?
Japan,
right? So they are definitely, and Buddhism actually originated in India and then spread, and it stuck in some countries and didn't stick so well in other countries, So Sri Lanka is Buddhist, but I wouldn't say that it exports as Buddhism, because I think there are other countries which are also Buddhist in themselves.
I think certain Buddhist countries see Sri Lanka as a sort of an original source for a lot of the
All right,
teachings.
All right, all right.
But
And could be because it has an ancient culture and it has an ancient Buddhist culture.
May I ask another question?
I
also went to a school back in my native Hong Kong. I recall it was around 35, 40 students in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. The difference was that in those days it was a very teacher-centric, top-down education. We all sat there. It's the stereotype that people have of Chinese education, memorization. I imagine now they've had to change that. And one reason is if you have a child-centric education with more emphasis on creativity and other things, you really need to have a smaller classroom. But you also need to have a differently trained teacher.
Absolutely.
So I guess my question is this. It sounds like a lot of it is economics also. Ideally, India would love to have 20 kids per class. I'm sure so would China.
Right.
So would many other countries, frankly, that they can't afford it.
Right.
That's the reason why they make do with unsatisfactory but economically realistic situation.
Right.
So with this new emphasis on child-centric, it's putting probably even more pressure on the inadequacy of an economic necessity. So I'm not quite sure whether these policies are just, in some ways, UN-driven nonsense because they're not really economically realistic.
Right.
I don't know.
No, and that's a great point, and I actually have written a lot about why child-centered education may not take or stick or be manifest in schools in Asia the way that we can see it here because of the challenges that they're faced. And one is, teacher preparation. Teachers don't know how to do it. Second, for good child-centered education, you need small groups of children because the whole premise is that there is one-on-one attention, there is documentation of children's work, there is project-based activity. You can't do these things when there are 40 children in the classroom. So you're absolutely right that, there's so many ground challenges in classrooms there. The reality of classroom life is such that they don't even have water and electricity, rural schools. They don't have chairs or desks to sit on. They're sitting on the floor. And so if they don't have water and electricity, then some of the essentials in a kindergarten classroom or a pre-K classroom in the U.S. is play with sand and play with water and all of those things, play with paint and play with all of that, They don't have all of that. They don't have water to wash their hands with. So how are they going to have a child-centered classroom? So absolutely, you're right that there are so many challenges.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is this a disaster?
I don't know. It's
one
just
thing to teach rote education, one teacher for kids. At least some of them will get an education. The ones who can handle education, even if it's not very creative. But if you have 40 kids, one teacher who's not trained to do child-centric, you could literally have 40 kids who are not getting anything.
Not getting anything.
So
the point that I make is that we need to maybe redefine what we mean by child-centered education. And maybe the definition we have in the Western world is not the definition we can apply to a child-centered education there. Maybe we need to have a modified, adapted version of child-centered education. But as long as we keep assessing and evaluating those schools according to the definition we have here, we're going to find them lacking. And that's exactly the point I make, is that we need to define it, redefine it for different contexts. That there can't be one kind of child-centered education. Oh, great.
I'm from China. So I get many information from your presentation. So in China, the early childhood teachers, they are kind of seeking the cultural identity. So that, the child-centered, the play-based integrated curriculum is like from the West. But they also want to, what is my identity, how far I can go, one question for you is, what led you to, you know, study these five countries, and what did your research team look like? And how did you get permission into different schools for the data?
I think one was convenience. I was trying to just make sure it's not too difficult to get, you know. So the selection of countries was India, Sri Lanka, and the Maldives. I was there as a Fulbright research scholar. So, you know, I was there on a scholarship, on a grant, on a research grant. I had to make my own connections. But because I've done a lot of prior work and I've written a lot already, I have those contacts. And so to get, you know, into schools and observe classrooms, into teacher education institutions, I met with policymakers, teacher educators, interviewed teachers, observed classrooms. So all of these things, I had to do it myself. I had to make my own contacts and through my contacts find out ways to connect with other people. Singapore, I was invited to the Institute of Education at Nanyang University as a visiting professor, and I was there. So because of being there on the faculty temporarily, I had colleagues, and we would go and visit all these kindergarten schools in Singapore. And China, I went there to present at a conference and made some connections and visited some schools. So it's like different, some of them, but I had to do it all on my own.
I'm just wondering how a lot of these policies seem to be kind of at the national, you know, political level. I'm just wondering how private institutions embrace them. Do these policies apply more? You said both government and
private,
right? Yeah. But my guess is that it could be mandated in a public system.
Absolutely.
Private system. Were those institutions kind of open and adopting these policies? Was
yeah.
Just voluntary, or was there any?
Yeah.
So
that's a good question. So these are national policies. Now, before these policies changed in earlier times, so when I first did my research 20 years ago, my first research, what I saw was private schools were already doing a little bit of, when I talked about the three discourses coming together, there was the British colonial textbook-driven exam discourse and then the Indian philosophical discourse where teachers were talking about the Indian cultural values. And then the third one was progressive education, which is child-centered education. And that was happening in private schools on its own because they had the resources to subscribe to American and European journals of education. They had the resources of calling early childhood educators from the West and giving workshops to their teachers, professional development workshops. So they had these resources. They were doing it a little bit on their own. But with the policies, it became like a mandate for all schools. Because what also happened in recent years is the teacher education system and the teacher qualification system also became very accountable and rigid. And so the NCTE, which is the National Council for Teacher Education in India, they also changed their policies accordingly. And that's the body that also recognizes whether teachers, schools, whether the schools are doing the right thing or not. So in that way, even private schools are mandated to do what the policy is. But I think they were already sold. They had already bought into that pedagogy.
So that's for new teachers. But then for existing teachers, that might they would require the kind of the retraining that you talked about.
They would probably need that. Yeah.
Did you discover any movements to reform funding policies or financial policies in any of these five countries that would make for more equitable distribution of educational funding?
The governments are definitely allotting a lot more funding in all of these instances because it's a government effort and it's a government policy, national policy. They have been allotting a lot more monies for education. And one of their main goals is across the board, they want to work towards more inclusion, more access and equitable education, and education for all, make sure that marginalized groups have access to education, because until now that has been a big issue also. So that's the effort and that's the goal of policies. How much of it happens eventually remains to be seen.
I understand
had a quick question because I noticed you had Reinaldo Machado up there.
Yeah.
I wonder if you are aware of the person that he took a lot of his theory from. It was
Paulo Freire. Yeah. Yes.
I think he nailed it.
Right.
All the way around.
Right. Yes. Thank you.
Do you think the obsession with English in Asia has to do with the fact that in this computer age, the people who have a knowledge of English can get better jobs, and these people feel that spending money on a private education is an investment, and therefore their children can get better jobs?
I think English is being viewed more and more as the language of power and the language of success. And so people see that, and people kind of, the public sees that people who know English are getting the better jobs, and so that's why they want to see. So that the perspective is that if you know English, you'll do better in life.
In India, though, are you seeing pockets? Because I know the majority of the population doesn't speak English, right? It's a small population that does, fluently.
Fluently, yeah, and again, there are degrees. Like, you know, a lot of people might know a smattering of English, and a few people might be very fluent in it, so... Yeah.
So are they learning it just for that reason, you think, or is there an education to learn within their cultures, within their country, to sort of formulate, like, translingualism?
Well, for the longest time, ever since India became independent of the British rule, the educational policy for language has been a three-language policy. So it's called the three-language formula, which means that any child going to school anywhere learns either English or Hindi, because Hindi is the national language, English is the national official language. So a lot of administrative work is also done in English. So because of the colonial past, English has been like a dominant language in India, almost one of the, you know, dominant languages in India. And so they learn either Hindi or English, and then, you know, their own family, because each state has a different language in India, so they learn their own family, mother tongue, and then another regional language. So you're required to learn three languages. I know when my sons went to school in India, they were learning Hindi and English, and then they could take up one foreign language. So...
Yeah,
right. Right, right. It's the same. It's pretty much the same. That primary schooling starts at the age of 5 or 6, and below that is pre-primary. They call it, so they don't call it early childhood so much. They call it pre-primary schooling. But
you already know the three stages: stay in one school, in a preschool institute, and then primary school.
So you would have nursery, maybe like in India you would have nursery schools. In Singapore and in Sri Lanka they're called preschools. So it's the terminology is a little different. But they can start that at the age of about 3. And then 3 to 5 they would go to nursery school or preschool. And then after that they would go to kindergarten in a primary school. And then below that there would be more daycare. And for birth through 3 would be more daycare. Okay, we've been sitting here for a long time, and you're probably just itching to get up and move around and go and enjoy the mild evening outside. So I just want to thank all of you being here on a Friday evening. Thank you for participating, and come.
Thank you.